Where is everybody? Any questions about anything from last time?
So we were talking about these bone fluctuations, right? And like the first one you showed us was like this, it had this exponential bit and this like little polynomial bit.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was at zero. It had value zero and every derivative was equal to zero.
Yeah.
And then the next one you did was this like 1 over like 1 minus x squared, was it? Or was it
one? It was 1 minus x squared to high powers.
Okay.
And I'm gluing it with zero outside the integral from minus 1 to 1.
And so the high powers...
It's going to be continuous. I'm not worried about high differentiability of this next one. I just want it to be continuous.
And why aren't you worried about the high differentiability?
Because I want to approximate uniform polynomials. The other one approximated all derivatives. I mean, so, but, yeah, so it depends on what the purpose of it is. This one is going to, the purpose of the polynomial one is to prove the Weierstrass lemma, a theorem, rather, about polynomial approximation. I'm going to finish that off right now, so I'll get right to that, and hopefully it'll become more clear in a minute. Any other questions? So, let's see. So I wanted to be a little bit more careful about that function I cooked up last time. The one that... it was 0 to the left. And let's see, e to the minus 1 over x t squared. As t goes to 0, that would go to 1. So actually, this thing looks more like this. It's nice and smooth. It goes up, and then it dies down to 1. Let's see, is that what it does? E to the negative... E to the something zero. Oh, it'd be less than one, wouldn't it? So it's actually let me try to figure out what this thing looks like. It would be nice and smooth, but then it would tend to e to the zero, which is one. So on this side, it's e to the minus one over t squared. And I told you that is a C infinity function. Yeah, so e to the minus something would be less than 1, and as time goes on, that would approach e to the minus... T gets big. That would be e to the minus something small. Right. So it would be tending to 1, e to the 0. So that's a better picture of it. But I wanted to be careful and show you that it's actually differentiable at the origin. It's clearly continuous at the origin. So this is I call this a phi 1. So phi 1 is continuous at 0. That's easy to check, because you know what the exponential does. As, let's see, minus 1 over t squared would go to minus infinity. And so e to the minus something minus infinity tends to 0. So it's continuous at 0. And so I'm setting it equal to 0 at 0. Now I want to show you that phi 1 is differentiable at 0. And so what I should have done if I wanted to be really careful about that last time was take the difference quotient, phi 1 of 0 plus h minus phi 1 at 0 divided by h. That would be e to the minus 1 over h squared minus e to the 0 over h. And so that's equal to e to the minus 1 over h squared minus 1 over h. And let's see, I could use what happens if the h goes to 0. That would go to... I'm sorry, phi 1 of 0 is 0. Right. And so what does this look like? This is going to look like, let's make 1 over h be something. What do I want to do? I'll make 1 over h be a t. And as h goes to 0, t is going to go to infinity. And this is going to look like e to the minus t over 1 over t. And so these are things that you studied back in freshman calculus using L'Hopital's rule. Or let's see, maybe a better way to do it would be to write this as t over 1 over t over e to the t. And remember, e to the t grows faster than any power of t. So this would go to 0 as t goes to infinity. And you did that by L'Hopital's rule. In fact, you only have to do it one time. If this was t to the n, you'd do L'Hopital's rule n times. And so this shows you that phi has a derivative from the left and from the right as I let h goes to 0. So t would go to infinity as h goes to 0. So I just showed you that phi is... Let's see, the right-hand derivative is 0, and the left-hand derivative is clearly 0. And so they match up, and that shows you that the left-hand derivative, that one's easy to see, equal to 0, and that's equal to the right-hand derivative. So phi is differentiable at 0, and its derivative is 0 there. And you can keep doing this. You just get higher. The more derivatives you take when you do this difference quotient thing at 0, you just get higher powers of t right here to mess around with. So phi 1 is differentiable at 0. And phi 1 prime of 0 equals 0. And it's just an induction. Let's repeat. For higher order derivatives. Okay, so that, any questions about that? I was a little bit sloppy the last time I did that. That gives me a C and C's. My goal there was to get a C zero infinity bump function. And I got one. And now I want to be a little bit more careful in cooking up my polynomial bump function. So this was for the Weierstrass theorem about density of polynomials. So the key is going to be a polynomial bump function. Okay, and so here's what my bump function... I'm going to start out with a sequence of bump functions. I want, in the end, I want a polynomial. So I want a bump function with these properties, such that here's the picture. It's going to be typical bump function. It looks like a bump. It's going to be 0 outside of minus 1 and 1. So I'm going to set it equal to 0 out here. And I'm not trying to make it infinitely differentiable. I'm making it continuous. And also, let's see, I want it to, this is going to be my q sub n. N's an integer. I'm going to have minus 1 over n here and plus 1 over n. And here's another 1 over n. I want it to be incredibly small outside this little tiny interval because I want all the mass to be concentrated there. So I'm going to make a dotted red line here at 1 over n. I want my qn, now it's 0 here, and then whammo, it's going to be a polynomial. I want it to stay less than 1 over n in this whole region here. And then it's going to get gigantic. And the area under the whole thing is going to be 1. And between minus 1 and 1, it's a polynomial. Okay. And I was a little bit sloppy in cooking that thing up last time. I'm going to be more careful right now. Obviously, from my picture, you can see that it's supposed to be greater than or equal to 0 also. In fact, it's strictly positive between minus 1 and 1. Okay, so here's step 1. I take my my function that's minus, it's, let's see, what is it? It's 1 minus x squared to the n. So it's going to be 0 here, and it's going to be nice and symmetric. It's going to be 1 here. This is 1 minus x squared to the n. Well, let's take to a high power. Okay, so it's 0 here and here, and I hook it up with 0 outside there. So it's going to be dead 0 outside. And it's a big fat 0 right there. The first thing I'm going to do is take care of getting this to be less than 1 over n in my interval. So if I take n big enough, so here's minus 1 over n and plus 1 over n. It's less than 1 here. So if I take gigantic powers of this thing, I can shrink this down until it gets below 1 over n. Okay, so what's the plan? Here's my 1 over n. If I take n big enough, I can make it go and be less than 1 over n here. Yeah, so let's see. It's going to go. I want it to be less than 1 over n here, and then it's going to go up into be 1. So I get this picture for big enough n. Okay, so the deal is I want it to be less than 1 over n outside the interval from minus 1 over n to plus 1 over n. So this is at the 1 over n level. It still goes up and is equal to 1 there. That's nice to know. Okay, so I've got that. And the next thing I'm going to do is I'm going to let this little bump poke out above 1 a little bit. So let's suppose my n is big enough so that I have this. The blue thing is just 1 minus x squared. And the red one is going to be 1 minus x squared to the n, and I make it go underneath 1 over n like that. And now if I take a little tiny epsilon and bump it up, so step two, I take 1 plus epsilon times my thing I just had, where epsilon is so small that I don't mess up what I got. It's got to be small outside my interval. So where epsilon greater than 0 is small enough that it doesn't mess up that 1 plus epsilon times 1 minus x squared to the n is less than 1 over n if x is bigger than, if absolute x is bigger than 1 over n. So it's still really small outside there. My epsilon is so small that it doesn't mess that up. Since I have an under there, some epsilon will do that. And now look at what I have. Step three. Okay, so now what I have, here's a minus 1 plus 1. My thing is really, it's 0 here, and then it stays really small, and then whammo, it gets big, and it goes small, and it's 0 outside here. This is going to be a little tiny interval where I can, there's going to be a little tiny interval where it's bigger than something. Why don't I make it bigger than 1 plus something small, let's say, on this interval here. Let's make this be 1 plus something tiny. How about a 1 plus delta? And that happens, let's see, here's a dot, here's a dot. Those are inside the 1 over n range. And here's 1 down there. So there's a little tiny bump that goes bigger than 1 plus delta. Now think about what happens if I start taking high powers. This would be, when I square it, it would be 1 plus delta squared. Or 1 plus delta cubed, etc. Higher hardened powers, I can make this thing on this region get bigger and bigger, which means it's going to contain a gigantic rectangle in the area. So I can make it arbitrarily, I can make the area under this thing arbitrarily big. So start taking bigger and bigger powers. Now take, so if you think about what I'm taking, I've got 1 plus epsilon times 1 minus x squared to the n to an mth power. I don't mess up, when I take powers like that, I don't mess up what I have here because these are less than 1. If I take powers, they get even smaller. So these get smaller and the area gets bigger. So keep doing that. With m so big that the area is bigger than 1. It doesn't mess up what I've already accomplished. We keep the good estimate outside. We wanted it to be less than 1 over n, and it stays that way. And then the last step is to divide by the area. That's if the area is bigger than 1, so when I divide by it, the area becomes 1, and because it's bigger than 1, it doesn't mess up this estimate. So the last step, what was this? Step 3. Step 4 is to divide by the area. Which is bigger than 1, so it doesn't mess that up. And so I get something that has area 1. So I got my Qn. So now now that I have it, now this thing is really a snap. So now the proof. I'm gonna. I think I told you, I assume that f of minus 1 equals 0 equals f of 1. If that's not the case, I can subtract off a linear function and make that happen. So I can subtract ax plus b to make this happen. After all, we're trying to approximate by polynomials. So if I subtract off ax plus b, I'm going to approximate by a polynomial. I can approximate my original one by a polynomial. Okay, and now I'll extend f to be 0 outside my interval. Okay, and so my step here is to, I claim, here's a couple claims, Qn convolved with f is a polynomial. I'll start with that claim. It's actually pretty easy. Let's see, my Qn convolved with f, remember, these things are compactly supported. And so Qn convolved with f at x would be an integral from minus infinity to infinity, Qn x minus t times f of t dt. That's the definition of convolution. And think about it. That Qn is a polynomial. And so I can write this as a summation am x minus t to the m, which when I multiply it out and collect terms is going to be a summation of c, all right, c I j, x to the I, t to the j. And now when I write these integrals out, I realize, aha, the x to the i's just pull out in front of the integral, and the rest is just are just numbers. So this integral is going to be an integral. Oh, let's see. That's true what I wrote there. Because f is supported between minus 1 and plus 1, this is actually an integral between minus 1 and plus 1. It's important that I do that before I do my next step. Now I do my next step and see that this is a sum of qij. X to the I pulls out in front of the integral, and I get an integral in t from minus 1 to 1 of t to the j times f of t dt. And there it is. These are just numbers. This is a polynomial in x. So this thing is a polynomial in x. So that's a check. And now the last step is to show that this thing converges to the original function. So claim Qn convolved with f converges to f uniformly on the interval from minus 1 to 1. Let's see why that's the case. So remember, let's see, the trick was this would be an integral from minus infinity to infinity of qn x minus t f of t dt. So let's see, I'm going to calculate here. I need to move this, sorry. What am I? I'm going to compute qn convolved with f at x minus f of x. And the big trick about approximations to the identity is that f of x I can write as f of x times 1, where 1 is the integral from minus infinity to infinity of q of t dt. That's 1. And now I change the variables in my convolution so that this is the new variable. So I would call this tau and do the change of variables. I've done that before, so I won't dwell on it here. Then I would get the integral from minus infinity to infinity of qn of tau f of x minus tau dt d tau. Minus the stuff. Let's see, I can change that t to a tau, so minus f of x. I can also stick the f of x inside the integral. I'll call this tau now instead of t, and I stick the f of x in there, d tau. That's just a simple change of variables. And now I'm in business. This is the integral from minus infinity to infinity of qn of tau times f of x minus tau minus f of x d tau. And there's two places to consider. Inside my little interval from minus 1 over n to 1 over n, that's where this thing is gigantic, but this is small by continuity. So f continuous on minus 1 to 1 implies f is uniformly continuous. And of course it's 0 outside minus 1 to 1, so it's going to be uniformly continuous on the whole real line. And, in fact, on R, because it's extended by 0. Okay, so there's going to be an N. Remember my 1 over N. So there exists, I'll call it a delta. Give me an epsilon bigger than 0. There exists a delta bigger than 0, such that f of x minus tau minus f of x is less than epsilon if tau is less than delta. Let's see, maybe I want it less than epsilon over 2. Pretty sure I do. Okay. Now, if my tau is going to be less than 1 over n, then I'll have this. So, if n is bigger, if n is such, is big enough that 1 over n is less than delta, then my integral, I'm going to copy this. I'm going to just keep messing around with this thing. Let's call this my integral I. I'm going to write my integral I as an integral tau is going to be bigger than 1 over n plus an integral where tau is less than 1 over n. In this region, that's where my q is really small. My q is going to be less than 1 over n there. So this is where q is small. And this is where the difference f of x plus tau, I guess I wish I have to write it out. Okay, this is qn of tau times my translation. X minus tau minus f of x d tau. And the other half is tau less than 1 over n. Let's make this greater than or equal to and this less. Okay, so the deal is this is small. The absolute value of that is small. And this one is less than 1 over n on this set. So we take this one, it's less than 1 over n on that set. So think of how big this could be. If f is bounded, yeah, I mean f is uniformly continuous in, on a closed interval, so it's bounded. So let's say it's bounded by m. The biggest this could be, get be would be 2m. So f continuous on a compact closed interval implies mod f, absolute f is less than some bound. It attains its max. So it's bounded by something. On minus 1, 1. And hence, because we extended it by 0, it's bounded by the same thing on the whole real line. And so my I here, that's my error, is going to be less than or equal to, let's see, what? How big could that be? Q is bounded by 1 over n. My f, when I stick the absolute values under the integral sign, my f's, I got an f, the first one would be an m, and my second one would be an m. And let's see, the length of that interval is 2 minus 2 over n. And so let's see, that's certainly less than or equal to 2. That's the length of the interval. That's the, what the first thing is estimated by. And the second thing is estimated by, let's see, that would be the integral of tau less than 1 over n, qn of tau, epsilon over 2, d tau. And now here's the neat thing about this. It's true that this thing is gigantic in that interval, but its integral is 1. And I'm integrating over even something less than the whole thing. So, good news. This thing is would be, in fact, strictly less than epsilon over 2 times the integral over the whole thing. Actually, it's minus 1 to plus 1.
Wait, you need to integrate over the whole thing?
Because I know that's equal to 1.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Yeah, that's the key to these bump function approximations to the identity. It's really important that this integral be 1, so that when I toss in, I can toss in even more, and I still don't get more than 1. Even though it's gigantic where this thing is small. The fact that it's an integrable gigantic makes everything okay. So this is equal to 1. And so you see my error, this is my error, my uniform error, is going to be less than or equal to 4m over n plus epsilon over 2 if my 1 over n is less than that delta. And so now I have to make n get even bigger. That would stay true, and I make n so big that this is less than epsilon over 2. Make n bigger than 1 over delta even bigger. So that that error, 4m over n, is less than epsilon over 2. So that's how you prove Weierstrass' approximation theorem, using an approximation to the identity. And notice we only needed it to be continuous. I didn't need it to be differentiable or anything. Although I could have made it pretty differentiable if I wanted to. Well, that's, yeah, so if you wanted to think about something neat, maybe you want to approximate even higher order derivatives. You know, when I take those high powers, that makes the hookup at the endpoints nice and smooth. And the higher the power, the smoother it is. So I could actually approximate not only the function, but higher derivatives by making that thing nice and differentiable. That'd be a fun thing to do. But that's exactly the kind of thing we're going to do when we study the Fourier transform. And the key to that is this function, a really important function called the Gaussian function. This is the most important bump. The Gaussian. Or I kind of like to call it the bell curve. And it's named after the shape, not a person. Let's see. It's basically e to the minus x squared. But because of the annoying square root of 2 pi's that come up in Fourier transform here and there, there's got to be you got to choose where your pi's come in. And Stein has chosen a certain place for the 2 pi's to pop up, which means that his Gaussian has to be, here's the bell curve, e to the minus pi x squared. This thing dies away incredibly rapidly at infinity. So when x is big, this thing is fizzling out really fast. And let's see, at 0, it's 1. So it, in fact, it's going to be very much like a good kernel. It's e to the, let's call this thing phi. Phi of x is always positive. Check. Notice it's really 0 far out. So phi goes to 0. And the other thing we want to check is that the integral from minus infinity to infinity of phi of x dx is equal to 1. And that's going to allow us to use this thing like an approximation to the identity. So let's see, I'm going to talk about properties. There's one property, two properties. Here's a mind-blowing property. The Fourier transform of this thing is itself. So that's mind-blowing. And so the cool thing about analyzing the Fourier transform is that if we understand this, and if we can use it to approximate other functions, then we'll understand other functions. That's the cool idea. Of course, doing it is going to take, for Stein, it took 5 pages. For me, it'll take 3 lectures. Stein knows how to do things efficiently. Anyway, I thought I'd show you this. I did enough technical stuff. I'll show you this one because it's easy and fun. You've probably already seen it someplace. So here's the key to that calculation. So here's 2. Here's the key. Integral from minus infinity to infinity of e to the minus pi x squared dx squared, I would write it as e to the minus infinity infinity e to the minus pi x squared dx, and that's just a dummy variable, so I would write it like this, pi y squared dy. I changed my dummy variable to from x to y. And if I stare at that and realize, aha, this is an iterated integral. And if this were finite integrals, you would believe Fubini's theorem. So this is equal by Fubini. I never remember how many n's in Fubini. Maybe it has 2 b's, I don't know. This is equal to the integral from minus infinity of the, this would be x going from minus infinity and y going from minus infinity to infinity, e to the minus pi x squared, e to the minus pi y squared, let's see, dx dy. So this is an iterated integral. It means first you integrate with respect to dx, that would give me the integral I want, and then the first one, and it would come out, and then all I'd have to be a constant times the y integral, and I can do it dy. Let's see, I got my x's and y's in the wrong spot. The inner integral is the x one. So I do it first, and then I do the second one. This is something you learn on a big bot, on like in a big rectangle. Fubini's theorem on a big rectangle. But this function dives away so fast at infinity that what you have this identity on a rectangle, and what's outside the rectangle is, it's so small out there you can forget about it. So that's how you would see that it holds even going to infinity. The outside, that it dies away so fast that you can throw away anything outside a big rectangle, and it's negligible. So if I wanted to be really picky about this, I'd say give me an epsilon bigger than 0, and I'd show this in limits. By looking out outside of a big rectangle, that function is so small that that part of the integral doesn't contribute enough to worry about. But now here's the fiendishly clever thing to do. This is an integral over the whole plane, dx dy. I can reparametrize that integral to be in polar coordinates. Now change to polar coordinates. Let's see, I guess there's one more step I should do before I do that. This is integral minus infinity to infinity, e to the minus pi x squared plus y squared dx dy. That's the element of area, and now I switch to polar. This is the element of area dA, and in polar coordinates, the element of area is r dr d theta. Now let's see, I'll take theta going from 0 to 2 pi, and my radius is going to go from 0 to infinity, that would give me the whole plane, and then I would have e to the minus pi r squared, and here's the cool thing, r d theta. By the way, there's no antiderivative of e to the minus pi x squared that you can write down. It's a famous example. Liouville studied it and showed it, that the antiderivative of e to the minus x squared exists, of course, as a function because of the fundamental theorem of calculus, but it's not an elementary function. You can't write a formula for it. Nonetheless, we can calculate this integral. And the reason is, now it looks like e to the u du. That's the key. So what I'll let, I will let u be equal to minus pi r squared, then du is minus 2 pi r dr. And that's the aha moment. R dr, which I have there, is minus 1 over 2 pi du. And to change variables there, when r is equal to 0, u is equal to 0. And as r goes to infinity, I don't want a minus there. Let's make it a plus. As r goes to infinity, u would go to infinity. And so my integral becomes the integral from r going from 0 to infinity, e to the minus pi r squared dr, r dr, would be an integral from 0 to infinity, e to the minus u, 1 over 2 pi u, du. And let's see, that's 1 over 2 pi comes out in front, and I would get minus e to the minus u from 0 to infinity. Of course, that means a limit to b as b goes to infinity. And that's equal to 1. Let's see, that would be minus 1. So it'd be 0 minus a minus 1, that's a plus 1. Okay, so that's the inner integral in my calculation up there.
Professor.
This one. And we get 1 over 2 pi, and then I integrate d theta, and that's going to give me the 2 pi. And 2 pi over 2 pi is 1. So I'm going to show you, I just showed you that this is equal to 1 over 2 pi. And so the last step, my iterated integral, continuing, integral as theta goes from 0 to 2 pi, 1 over 2 pi d theta, and that's 1. Check. That bell curve has area 1. And it's going to be, we're going to treat it like a bump function. And so in fact, my approximation to the identity is going to be remember I took phi sub epsilon of x is 1 over epsilon phi of epsilon x. That's going to have area 1, but it's going to concentrate all the power near the origin. And it's going to be really small far out. So that's going to be the approximation to the identity. And we're going to understand the Fourier transform of this thing, and convoluting something with this thing is like adding up little bump functions to equal the function. And if we understand the Fourier transform on these, we'll understand the limit, hopefully. It'll turn out beautiful. That's a good place to stop for today. Did everybody get their paper up here? Jeez, you know, it's due next Monday.
Oh, it's the next Monday.
Yeah, sorry about that. I should have emphasized that.
Oh, okay.
It was written on the homepage. Apparently, people were so expecting it to be due today, they didn't even notice.